The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
As a person with a very deep voice, I'm hired all the time for advertising campaigns. But a deep voice doesn't sell B2B, and advertising on the wrong platform doesn't sell B2B either. That's why if you're a B2B marketer, you should use LinkedIn ads. LinkedIn has the targeting capabilities to help you reach the world's largest professional audience. That's right, over 70 million decision makers all in one place. All the big wigs, then medium wigs. Also small wigs who are on the path to becoming big wigs. Okay, that's enough about Wix. LinkedIn ads allows you to focus on getting your B2B message to the right people. So, does that mean you should use ads on LinkedIn instead of hiring me, the man with the deepest voice in the world? Yes. Yes, it does. Get started today and see why LinkedIn is the place to be, to be. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
What is The Briefing Room?
It's a behind-the-scenes look at how the criminal justice system works and the lives of the people within that system.
If you love true crime, well, these are the real people who do the job every day of making sure justice is served.
Hi, I'm Detective Dave.
I'm Detective Dan. Together, we have decades of experience in local law enforcement, a profession that we think is often misunderstood.
So we're going to explore how to do it right, and we won't shy away from when it's done wrong. These are stories you'll hear nowhere else. Unique, frank, and unvarnished.
From the team that brought you Small Town Dicks, this is The Briefing Room. Episode 1 drops on August 30th. We'll meet you in The Briefing Room.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
In each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, our guest is Carter Smith, the director of several horror films, such as the fantastic adaptation of The Ruins and 2019's Midnight Kiss episode of Into the Dark. He's also an accomplished photographer. His latest project is All the Dead Boys, a deep dive into the world of queer fear and body horror, as well as the upcoming horror film Swallowed. Welcome to the show, Carter!
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
We're so excited to have you here and talk with you. I've been wanting to chat with you for forever.
And I've been listening for a long time, so...
Aww. Thank you.
people listen to our podcast?
I know. It's something I'm still not used to when people say this to. I'm like, really? But let's take it back to the beginning. How did you get introduced to horror?
I mean, you know, a story that I've heard like so many people tell on this very podcast. I mean, going to the video store, like, yeah. You know, bringing home, you know, videos based on box covers. I mean, and that was kind of it. That was, you know, where it started. It was just, you know, I wasn't into comedies. I wasn't into like, I mean, maybe before movies, I started reading Stephen King books.
Okay.
When I was really young. I grew up in Maine. And so there was this like, oh, there's this guy from Maine. And so I read, you know, The Shining and Carrie and Salem's Lot when I was like really way too young to be taking that stuff in. And so it probably started with reading more than films.
How did you get introduced to Stephen King?
Yeah.
Was it a parent or was it like at the library?
No, you know what? Good question. I don't actually remember. Like, I mean, I remember reading Jaws when I was in fifth grade. And then that, like, and I remember asking my mom what humping was, because there was something about like humping in the bushes. And like, and I mean, I think it was just, they didn't never read any Stephen King. So I don't actually know where those paperbacks came from.
You know, thinking about it, Jaws was my first introduction to like nudity in books, because there's that sequence where, because in the book it's a little different than the movie, where Chief Brody's wife has an affair with Hooper, and there is like this part where she's imagining getting into a car accident because she's not wearing panties at this restaurant, and like she's just found with her vagina out into the world. And I was young, I was probably in fifth or sixth grade at the time, going, what is this?
And humping to boot.
And humping, yes.
Like the worst. I'm sorry. That's the worst word ever. Yeah. Like, it's so gross.
I can't remember what her explanation for it was, but it was not as exciting as it seemed like it should be.
I was like, what? Yeah. Never ask you that question again. What was your first Stephen King book?
I think it was probably Carrie.
Ooh,
I mean, I started at the beginning.
Like, yeah, cool.
I mean, it was, I was really into the, like, the, that whole, you know, kind of the first 10 years of, you know, Salem's Lot and The Shining and Carrie. And that was sort of my introduction. I was less into the other, the sort of the, when they got longer and more complicated. And like, as a young reader, I was kind of into like the clean, I mean, not that they're clean, but like the more, streamlined, I guess. I don't know.
Little more focused on like a character or two rather than like
a big
super
sweeping,
complicated.
Like, I didn't read The Stand until I was much older. I was like super intimidated by it.
I'm still
intimidating book.
I'm still intimidated.
Yeah. And also like Night Shift. That actually may have been one of the first one, the short stories.
Yeah, that collection of short stories.
That fucked me up as a child. Yeah. Like that was one of the first Stephen King books I also read. And the one about the boogeyman.
Yes.
Was the scariest story I've ever read. My dad had me read it. I threw the book at him and I started crying. I was like 8. So that was why I wasn't. But it was, that's a good collection of short stories. Like, good Lord.
And then Clive Barker. I got my hands on the Books of Blood really, really young too.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I wonder, like, who was like feeding you these books?
I mean, there was a bookstore. Like, I grew up in like small town Maine, and there was one bookstore, and I would find them myself. Like, I was always in that bookstore, you know, kind of lurking, and it was the bookstore and the video store were next door to each other.
Hell yeah,
that's amazing. I also was a bookworm growing up, and so I would spend so much times at like B. Dalton's and Walden Books, just like going through all of those those sections.
I hung out at the Borders all the time at the mall.
Yeah,
in the horror section,
and all of those like the paperbacks from hell, like that era of like trashy, really fun, disgusting books.
I'm so glad that they brought some of those back. I like signed up for that subscription through paperbacks through From Hell or whatever, and it's like just getting some of those old books like The Nest and some of the ones that like I remember seeing the covers for but I never read growing up.
Have you ever read Spawn? I think it's called Spawn.
No.
I think it's like a custodial worker at a hospital that collects the fetuses from aborted children and then brings them back to life in some sort of ritual, and they turn into these little monster things.
I like to read that.
It might be like Sean Houston or Huston, whatever, however you say his name, the guy that wrote Slugs.
Oh right, yeah.
Wow.
So do you remember what your first horror movie was that you probably saw?
You know, it was also probably Jaws. I mean, I kind of consider that a horror movie, but like quickly after that, I started on the, you know, the sort of Halloween, Friday the 13th, Texas Chainsaw, like the sort of those classic slasher type films. I don't remember the first one though, to be honest, because as soon as I saw the first one and I kind of realized how much I loved them, it was like I wanted all. And then I was bringing home, like, you know, as there was like a limit on how many videos you could rent, you know, per night. So we would go on like Friday nights, and I could bring home like 4 movies.
Hell yeah. That was my childhood too. Just going out, renting a whole bunch of movies and spending the weekend watching them. Gosh.
Yeah.
Nothing better. Now it's like, I don't know, it's just at the tip of your fingers and it just seems a little
too easy to pause, skip, delete, leave.
I will say, as someone who grew up in like the 2000s, and had more access to that stuff, it was still really fun to sneak that when your parents were asleep and you could go on demand when they weren't awake. Yeah. And you can pick. It's not the exact same, and I still went to Blockbuster, but there was still something kind of exciting about that.
Yeah.
Also, didn't know they carded a Blockbuster to rent rated R movies until one day someone finally carded me, and I was so mad that I couldn't rent my movies on Halloween. I was so pissed. I was come on, they always think I'm 17.
They would make my parent check the movies out for me. I wasn't allowed to take anything out on my own.
I guess that's fair. My dad did check out most of the movies because he wanted to watch them with me, so I didn't really think there would be a problem. I was like, oh yeah, they just let anyone rent any old horror movie from the Blockbuster.
The first mom and pop's video store that we had when I was living in Alaska, they allowed my parents to sign a note allowing people to like rent movies. And so you just go there and you had a note on file and they would let you rent specific movies. And
did you forge their signature?
No, my parents let me. They were very specific on what they could. And this mom and pop store was very a little over helpful, where it's like, OK, so these are the movies that you can rent.
Yeah, my video store was the same. It wasn't a Blockbuster. It was a mom and pop, and I was allowed to rent. You know, I mean, they had to like you just said, sign off. But like, I was pretty much allowed to rent most anything that I wanted.
Yeah, that was when my parents were a little bit more liberal on that side when I was young, and then it became like you can't look at anything that has nudity in it. And I'm like, you mean breasts? And that doesn't really matter to me. But okay, I will sign off on this.
Sure.
I will close my eyes during those parts. Yes. switching to being an adult, what draws you to the genre now as an adult?
I mean, I think that it's like constantly searching for that like physical reaction, you know, like the twisted stomach and the sort of shivers and I mean, I think that horror is so, what I always loved about it is how it affected me physically, how it made me feel. Like as a, you know, like comedy makes you laugh and, you know, but horror always I liked when it made me squirm, and I liked when it made me recoil, and when it I wasn't so into a fanboy for different killers and for me, it was always more about feeling, it feels so weird to say this, but feeling disgusted or feeling, petrified or feeling creeped out or, that physical feeling, I think, was something that, I was always chasing after I became a big horror fan.
So what are some movies that gave you that feeling initially?
I remember Texas Chainsaw being really affecting early on. And it was one of the first times that I, felt a punch to the stomach. I mean, I guess Evil Dead, probably the first one. But I also remember Evil Dead being one of the first times when I remember thinking oh, there's a filmmaker who made this film, and which was kind of interesting and exciting to me. But I mean, yeah, Texas Chainsaw. I mean, I think that it becomes harder and harder to, as you guys know, get that same rush in the same way.
Yeah, I was going to ask, have you felt that recently, in the past couple of years watching anything? Is there anything that has kind of given you that feeling?
Have you guys seen Climax?
Yes, yeah, I have.
Yeah, I mean, the Climax was drug addict, full, oh my God, yes, this is the feeling that, and I saw it on a matinee at 2 o'clock in the afternoon alone in a theater.
That's incredible. Honestly though, that sounds like a vibe though. I feel dirty. Is this a porn theater a little bit? I feel a little squicky.
There was two or three people in there only. It was amazing. And then just stumble back out into the daylight.
Oh, I can't imagine because it's you're in there and that is a singular vision of a acid trip gone awry.
And you are in it.
There's no escape, especially if you're in a movie theater. There's no pausing. There's none of that. So I can't. I think the last experience that I had that was when I went to go see Mandy, a film that I'm not 100% sold on. But watching that in the movie theater and then leaving, it feels like the world is moving much faster than I was anticipating it to, because that movie is just so deliberately slowed down.
Yeah.
It just – oh, those experiences.
I know. That's what we're chasing. And then did you guys – have you guys seen The Untamed?
Yes.
Yes, that's the alien in the
Mexican horror movie. Yes. Yeah. That's like possession. It's like basically possession, but gayer and
weirder and hotter and like it's more beautiful. Like, yeah,
so fucking good. Yeah. It's that perfect feeling of like, oh, but also,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, those two and maybe Possessor. Like are the last, the sort of three movies that made really like those are the types of films that made me love horror, I think, and keep me loving horror.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Those are really good choices. Oh my God.
They're a little artsy for a lot of people. Like I tell people about them and then like they're sometimes like,
climax. Come on. The dancers go do get drugged and they just do fucking horrific shit to each other. In a warehouse that, for like 12 hours.
Dance number is so good. Oh, yeah.
It's perfection. Yeah. But the artsy films, I mean, Mary Beth and I have talked about this before where it's like we get asked for horror recommendations from people that aren't interested in the horror genre as like in depth as we are. And it's always like, I don't know if you want recommendations from me because it would be something along the lines of like Climax or some artsy fartsy film that like everyone's like,
But I actually you guys turned me on to Empty Man, which I had not even heard about.
The Empty Man Hive grows.
Yes. I was so happy to have found that movie. I was like, I was so thankful that you guys talked about it.
Isn't that wild? That movie shouldn't exist and it does. And I'm so glad that more and more people are watching it and appreciating it because it's so fucking weird, but like in the best way possible.
Yeah, totally.
So I have a question because I think you and I are about 10 years apart in age and we grew up in such a different time than like queer kids growing up now. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious about your experience with queerness and horror and how the two kind of overlap. And I wanted to segue this into talking about All the Dead Boys in particular. But I was kind of curious about what it was like growing up for you, because I feel like kids today, things are, not perfect, but things are so much better than the decades before when we were growing up.
Well, there wasn't any queerness in horror. There was, kind of like, some like subtext and some villains and some, but like the extent of my queer horror experience was Nightmare on Elm Street 2. Like, and that was just like having a crush on Mark Patton, like, because he was like, the cute, comfortable, confident queer kid that I wasn't, that like dared to wear that like pastel shirt and like feather his hair and like do all the stuff that I wanted to do, but I didn't dare to do in my like rural high school. But like, it was, I was very much like a solo loner horror kid. Like I felt like horror was one of the genres where as a queer kid that felt pretty isolated. Like I could get into the stories and I didn't see myself in the stories necessarily, but I could identify with a final girl who, was fighting her way, against all of her, demons. But yeah, I mean, it's only like fairly recently that queer horror has, kind of become a thing.
Absolutely. And, I think it's interesting that you bring up, because like for me, you brought up Mark Patton in Nightmare on Elm Street 2. And for me, it was definitely like the Nightmare on Elm Street series that I would see myself in as sort of like those outsider kids. Because like you said, we didn't really necessarily have, queer people to look up to in film. And for me, it was like Alice and I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but Alice in the Dream Master, Nightmare on Elm Street 4, where it's like you see her kind of going through that sort of meek sort of like wallflower into like owning her sexuality. And I think that's kind of all we kind of had growing up.
Yeah. It was like a stand-in for our, sort of imagined the stories that we would imagine or that I imagined for myself, that I wasn't necessarily brave enough. I wasn't quite as brave as those,
me neither.
Those girls, but I wanted to be, and they kind of like gave me hope that, it was possible.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I also know that you are a fashion photographer and you have done that aspect of it. I was curious, when did you become interested in both photography and filmmaking? Was it something you've always been interested in, or was it later in life? Or
Yeah, I was taking pictures in high school even.
Okay.
And I was doing, and I was reading fashion magazines and, you know, I was always sketching and, you know, I somehow like, I ended up thinking that like between fashion magazines and drawing, you know, kind of, I mean, cause strangely as a gay kid, I was also drawing like these sexy, like barbarian chick type, you know, image. Mm-hmm. I was like super into like the Conan, like combat stuff. And I mean, I was taking tons of pictures and I ended up moving to New York right out of high school. Okay. And went to FIT study fashion design of all things.
Oh,
and
wow.
Like, you know, hated it and switched to photography almost immediately, but kept taking pictures and, you know, kind of fell in with this group of friends who were all sort of aspiring fashion kids. And, it felt like photography felt like a way that, that was accessible to make images and tell stories, like without needing big crazy cameras and equipment and crews. Mm-hmm. And like, I could very much just like me and a model, we could like go out on the street and like do a photo shoot. And yeah, like, you know, having done a semester in fashion design, I could like sew the dress and I could like do the hair and makeup. And like, so I mean, I kind of did it all like in the very beginning. And then, you know, like one thing kind of led to another, and I certainly never planned to be a fashion photographer, but like the jobs started coming in and they started getting better and better. And like, and it was super fun. Like I got to travel all over the world and work with, you know, amazing people. And,
yeah,
you know, so I kind of embraced it and decided to go with it. And like kept this weird, like dark horror thing, like deep down inside, like, you know, suppressed.
And how did you get involved in actual filmmaking then?
I had read a short story. Do you remember the first anthology called Queer Fear?
Yes.
So there's a short story in there called, I think it was actually volume two, called Bug Crush.
Yes.
And I read that short story and I'd always wanted to make films. And I like the only reason I went to FIT is because I thought that NYU would be too expensive and it would take too long to take any interesting classes. And I read that short story and I was like, this is my short film. Like, this is the film that I should make as my first short. And, you know, I called up Scott Treleaven, the author, and managed to option it and wrote it. And like, at that point I'd been doing stills for a good like 10, 12 years. And so I had this group of people around me, like costume and makeup and production design. And like, I had people that on my team that we were used to working together. And so I basically just called everyone. I was like, we're making a movie.
Oh, wow.
And that was my first short, film. And it was not short at all. It was like 37 minutes and we ended up getting into Sundance and then winning best short film.
That's amazing. Like,
you know,
that's amazing.
Kind of best case scenario.
Yeah. Dang, that's so cool.
Yeah.
And that is currently streaming on Deku and it's really good.
Yeah.
I really like that. I like that short film.
Yeah. And that 100% led to, you know, I got an agent. It led to The Ruins, you know, which was my first feature.
Yeah. What was it like working with that script and adapting that story?
I was reading the book in hardcover, like the week that it came out, and I had just signed with my agent, and they said, okay, we're going to send you a script. It's for this book that just came out called The Ruins. And I was like, I'm reading it right now. I'm like 50 pages in. And the script was great. And I kind of fell in love with it and sort of decided, like, I mean, I never imagined that I would make like studio movies, really. I imagined like dark, weird, little, strange independent films would be the movies that I would make. But I was like, okay, I will, you know, I want to go through the process of like meeting on this and pitching on it and, you know, and trying to get this job. And it took me about a year of meetings, like going through one level and then saying, okay, we'll call you later. And then 2 months later, getting another call and like going in and pitching it to the next person. And it took about like a year until I finally got my last and final pitch meeting with Steven Spielberg.
Wow. And,
like, it was crazy bonkers. And he just spent the first 20 minutes of the meeting talking about Bug Crush.
Wow. That's amazing.
Like, I was kind of like, I just sat there with my mouth dropped open and like, you know, it was kind of amazing. Yeah.
I would have been like, I wouldn't have been able to speak.
Yeah.
I would have been like, Thank you.
But also like who, like I would never imagine that I would make, I would want to make a movie about like killer plants. Like, like that's not, you know, like that is not, you know, like in my wheelhouse necessarily, but like, I love the characters. I love this like weird survival element and how they turned on each other and that like it kind of worked so well as a character piece and that the plants were just like egging them on to, I mean, if you think about it, like, you know, the plants don't really kill, I mean, I guess they kill Matthias because they go down his throat, but like, you know, they sort of make everyone else turn on each other and they end up killing each other, which to me is so much scarier.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, I just, I think Scott Smith is such an interesting figure because like, he seems, I don't know if he is for in the real world, but he seems kind of reclusive. Like he's written two novels. They've both gotten fantastic adaptations. And I know he's like written scripts and stuff since then, but like,
where's the amazing next book, that, Scott?
I know. Seriously. When's the next book?
Cause he's, I don't know how reclusive, I mean, he was 100% like around and available while we were working. Yeah. I mean, he did the adaptation himself, but he was also like super open. Like we were, you know, doing polishes and rewrite, you know, working on changing stuff, like even when we were during the shoot, and he was super collaborative and
that's awesome
and into it. So
he just like, I just want to know more about him too, because like I said, he's written two books and they have both gotten fantastic adaptations. And it's like,
whatever, casual. As like
a reader, it's like, where's more? I want to see what you're going to create next.
Like, how many years? Like 10, 12 years since that?
I know.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. It's crazy. Okay. So All the Dead Boys, I've been following it on Instagram for a while, but can you tell our listeners what this project is about and what you're doing with it?
Yeah. So All the Dead Boys started, because the photography and the fashion photography that I do is like celebrities and it's pretty and it's commercial and it's like, it's a very different aesthetic from like, you know, my horror self. And like, so going off to make The Ruins and going off to make Bug Crush and then coming back to doing these like beautiful, pretty pictures, like it was such a divide.
Yeah.
And you know, more and more the fashion industry became, you know, you're working in advertising and there's tons of clients and there's tons of people standing around the monitor and it's sort of image making by committee a lot of the time. And there's client, I mean, not that there's not clients and all those same relationships in filmmaking, but I had sort of fallen out of love with making pictures. And I was like, I wanted to get back to what made me fall in love with it in the first place, which was like, you know, doing the makeup and like making a costume and just doing it one-on-one, like just me and the person I was photographing. And so I was like, okay, what do I love? I love blood and bruises and guts and scrapes and naked boys. So I was like, that's what I will do. And I'll call it All the Dead Boys. And it was, I mean, basically it was just a way for me to like explore that like really kind of precarious place where like horror and the horrific meets the beautiful, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking about this, particularly when you mentioned The Untamed, where it's like you're watching this and you're like, am I supposed to be horrified? Am I supposed to be a little titillated? What is going on here? And it's kind of that kind of feeling I get looking at these pictures. And I love that. I love that area.
Yeah. Well, it's a place that, I mean, it makes people really uncomfortable, which, you know, I mean, I, for me, it's such a like sweet spot of creativity that I'm always a little bit, I mean, I understand that people are uncomfortable or made uncomfortable by it, but it does walk this fine line of like what kind of turns you on and what makes you want to look away and what makes you, you know, squirm a little bit. And, you know, that's always been like a super fun place for me to explore.
They definitely hit that sweet spot. So you're on Instagram and you also have a website. Is there other things involved with that?
I just did what I consider to be like my kind of first All the Dead Boys film, like the feature film, Swallowed.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's very much an All the Dead Boys film. You know, it's something that like, you know, it lives exactly in that spot. But basically like, you know, there's the website, the Instagram, and I did a short, an All the Dead Boys short a couple years ago, which was, I mean, what defines it as an All the Dead Boys short for me is the fact that it was like two, three people, you know, no client, no expectations, and like very queer fear. And then Swallowed is the same, lives in the same sweet spot.
Can you tell us anything else about Swallowed, or is it still kind of like under wraps?
It stars Jenna Malone and Mark Patton.
It definitely does.
Yeah.
I'm excited for that.
That's pretty fucking cool. That's pretty
cool. Your girl crush and my boy crush are...
My girl crush, shut up alone. Yeah.
They're together at last.
Oh my God.
And it kind of takes place in the same world as Bug Crush.
Okay.
Cool.
Awesome.
Which is like rural Maine, backwoods, like dark, gay, you know, kind of horrificness.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. That sounds incredible.
Yeah.
That
I'm
sounds
sold.
Like
can
something
we watch
I
it
can't
now?
Wait
I
to watch.
We're only starting to edit. We only wrapped shooting like last month. So
I know.
We are very like early stages. So cool. I am just now watching all my dailies.
That's cool. Amazing. That's exciting. I'm so excited for this.
I'm very excited to share it with you guys. Because if you like all those movies that we were talking about and Bug Crush and all the Dead Boy, you're going to be very, very intrigued. Well,
Mary Beth and I were talking right before you popped on, and I'm just going to share that you also have this guy in it that his IMDb page, he's very attractive, Cooper Koch.
Oh, Cooper. Yeah, Cooper Koch. Yeah. Koch. He's amazing.
We were talking about him. I was like, well, let's look at his photo and thirst over him before we let Carter in. But now we will do
now
it.
I'm just going to talk about it.
it's totally understandable. He is amazing, and he's so good, and he is fully buck naked for the last like 40 minutes of the film.
Again,
oh my God, last 40
can
minutes.
This? Can we watch
Yay.
This movie?
Oh
now?
My God, more nudity and horror. You yes. think there yes, would please. Be more of it?
Yeah, but
that's not just titties. And yeah. I cannot wait.
Well, I got when I was doing the ruins, we had like there was a scene in the beginning with Jenna and Jonathan Tucker, her boyfriend, in the hotel room getting dressed and ready to go, and they would not let me put a shot of Jonathan Tucker's bare ass in that scene because they thought they're like, you have to remember this is going to be huge in a theater and nobody wants to look at a butt that big. And I was like,
excuse me?
What?
Really? Yeah. So let's just say,
do you know your audience?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I was like, come on, people.
You have to, I want to see, that's how I want to see butts.
Exactly.
Giant on a giant screen.
Yeah.
Give me those giant butts.
Yeah.
Give me
transitioning from giant butts, Carter, what movie did you bring with you today for us to discuss?
I brought David Cronenberg's The Brood.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So The Brood, David Cronenberg, incredible film. Yes. A man tries to uncover an unconventional psychologist's therapy techniques on his institutionalized wife amidst a series of brutal murders.
That's a pretty fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very short.
Yeah.
And very short. Very to the point.
Vague. But
yeah.
I don't think it really kind of covers the depth of this movie, but yeah. that's on IMDb. So let's dig into that. I want to know, how old were you when you saw this movie? I just want to know everything. Like, give us your horror story. Cause I just, with the moment you said this, I was like, oh, I got to hear it.
I was probably like 13.
Okay. Wow.
You know, way too young. And like, so the way that like our Fridays were set up at my household is my little sister had like ballet class. And while she was in ballet class, we would go to the video store and the bookstore where I would pick up all my Stephen King and Clive Barker and like my horror movie haul home for the weekend.
What an incredible Friday routine.
Yeah.
That
so
sounds
then
great.
We would go back to class and there was like a waiting room where all the parents would wait for their kids. And in the waiting room was this mother. I don't remember her name. I remember very clearly what she looked like. And she would always see me with these movies. And after about like 4 or 5 weeks, she was like, so you like horror movies? And I was like, yeah, you know, 13-year-old me. And so the next week she brought an unmarked VHS tape.
Those are always the best.
Like, no, it wasn't no sticker, no title, nothing. She was like, try, watch this. And so I brought it home and I watched it and I was like forever changed. I had no idea. I mean, I thought it was going to be like a killer with a mask and like a, you know, or a demon or, you know, but no, it was The Brood. And it was not a movie that they had at the video store. So that's what scarred me for life was like that ballet mom who like slipped me the unmarked tape.
I love that she was an amazing sequence like in my head of just like a mom in a ballet class brings a 13-year-old A 13-year-old boy, an unmarked videotape had watched this. Yeah, if you like
it,
horror.
She, like, slipped it to me. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like she like asked my mother, like, oh, I brought a movie for your son. Like, no, she like slipped it to me.
Slipped it in. There you go. Yeah.
So, okay, this. What was your experience watching it? Like, what about watching The Brood changed you?
I mean, I had the VCR. I would take it up to my bedroom, and so I watched it alone, like, in the middle of the night. And I remember it was the first horror film that I'd seen that felt strangely like realistic and possible. Mm-hmm. Like, there wasn't any demon, there wasn't any possession, there wasn't any crazy masked killer. Like, there was like psychoplasmics. And I was like, psychoplasmics could be real, I guess. Like, it seemed 100% like something that was, you know, possible. And I think that's what terrified me the most.
Yeah. Do you remember any specific scenes that might have jumped out at you while you were watching it?
Oh, I mean, like anything with this. Like, the murder in the kindergarten is like still to this day. Like when I just rewatched it recently, like, it wasn't as horrific as it was in my memory. I mean, actually, that's not true. It's still horrific. But like, that scene terrified me, and watching those kids react to it. And I mean, you know, of course, like this first scene in that yellow kitchen, you know, when the Brood kills her grandmother. And mm-hmm. I mean, basically anything with the Brood, like the scene at the end in the bunkhouse. I mean, all of it was traumatizing.
The teacher's death in particular, what really like jumped out at me on this watch is the fact that up until now, all of the deaths have been like one-on-one type things where people, it's always been the Brood monster killer and then whoever they're killing.
One person, yeah.
Right. Whereas here it's like bright daylight in some place that is, especially if you're a kid, supposed to be like safety. Yes. Yeah. It's supposed to be like a safe space, and they're watching their teacher get brutally beat to death.
Like, moments after they were dropped off by their parents. Like,
yeah. It's horrifying.
And they're just sitting there, like, and like, not knowing what to do. Like, it was,
well, and moments like that, like, I, you know, this is obviously very much a movie about trauma and intergenerational trauma and, you know, the trauma that parents inflict upon their children. But like, also the trauma that all those children, like, no, like, obviously they're just characters. But in my head, I'm like, what does that mean for that kid for the rest of their life to have seen this horrific murder of their teacher and have no, will they ever fully get context for what happened? Probably not. But then they'll have that forever, like, in their heads. And like, that in itself is so fascinating about like that trauma and what that means for those children as they grow
up. That kind of trauma never affects just one person or one generation.
Oh, I love it. This is my favorite Cronenberg movie. And I know that like, this is maybe a lesser discussed Cronenberg movie, I guess.
Oh,
and I know
it's my favorite too.
It's my favorite. And yeah. I think it's the first Cronenberg movie I ever saw. I saw it in college as part of a horror film class I took, and I had an amazing professor. He was like an older gay guy who was just like an incredible horror historian and was like, we're going to watch the films that like you guys probably won't encounter or have like easily encounter in your lives. We watched The Brood, and like my mind was absolutely blown about what it was and what body horror could be. And like what you said, it could be so really realistic and linked like psychological trauma and the manifestation of body horror through your own trauma. Like that, like the beginning when he's on the, I think, is it the beginning when he's on the stage?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like they're having the opening that really scene. Weird,
intense one-on-one
intense,
in the spotlight
intimate
with all those people watching
moment.
Them.
Yeah. And it's like, it's such a weird tone to set, but it's the perfect tone. Like it's so good. It's going to be so emotionally intense and a little bit icky, but really fascinating. And I think that opening sequence like was like, oh, this is going to be something really special. And then it just completely like spirals, because I had seen we were reading about it and I saw the picture of Nola like exposing her external womb, and I was like, oh, it's gonna be gnarly. It's gnarly, but it's not as like Cronenbergian gnarly as a lot of his other stuff, but I love that.
Yeah, well, I think that, I mean, for like the kids, the Brood were what was so gnarly for me, like the idea of these kids in snowsuit, like, and watching it and rewatching it, it's like every from that very first moment you see Candy in her snowsuit. Like, it's just like you're trained to, mm-hmm. you know, your eye goes to them and you're like, oh fuck, is that, you know, what's going to happen? Is that a brute? Like, there's something so right. normal about it. And I love yes. that it made, you know, the normal so horrific. And also like, and I think that I didn't realize this at the time when I first watched it, but I definitely realized it later, was like, I was also really into it because to me, it was kind of beautiful. Like, the way that it was photographed and the sets and the hair, like Samantha Eggers' hair.
Yeah.
But
the light behind her hair, though, too. Yeah, like, she looks like this hell angel.
And it's kind of perfect and sultry and, like, you know, and, like, Oliver Reed, like, you know, his, like, short little bathrobe and his little leather mules. Like,
yes.
I was super into all of it.
I was so into him. I was like, he's hot as fuck. Like, I don't even care. Like, yeah, he's gross, but, like, I had never seen Oliver Reed in a movie before.
Yeah,
and I was like,
who
is this man?
Yeah.
This fascinating man. And now I know more about him.
Charismatic.
And
he has a lot of presence.
His chin. Exactly. Like, he is the only person I feel like could play that character in my head, because he is so manipulative and he really embodies that charisma and that, he's like, very good at gaslighting, but also, like, Terry, you wrote this note. He's a Frankenstein. Like, he is Dr. Frankenstein.
Yeah, totally.
And he embodies that so well in this movie. And like you said, his like little short robe, and like, he's definitely kind of sexy
little, like,
and like
hot assistant, like, guy.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Like,
what's going on there?
But like, the more I watch it, the more I'm like, this is a little, like, he's definitely like kind of hitting on all of his patients. Like, he's definitely, I don't know if he actually is attracted, but he's like definitely like very sexually attracted to a lot of his patients. And like, it's really obviously inappropriate. But it's the dynamics are very fascinating there, besides just doctor and patient.
Talking about the fashion though, also, Frank. When he shows up in that like beige coat with like the
coat.
Red scarf, and his hair is perfectly coiffed.
His hair,
like,
oh my god,
so good. Yeah,
his hair is incredible.
So attractive.
I had a so
attractive. In this movie
sure.
is kind of hot. It's weird how hot people are in this movie.
Yeah, kind of all of them.
Yeah.
Maybe not the guy with the thing on his throat.
Yeah, that's
that
a little.
Guy.
But
like, can you even imagine what it would be like if your traumas manifested physically on your body? Like,
oh,
holy
god.
Shit. Like, that is thinking about that, you're like, oh god. Like, it's
talk
just
about,
so
like, queer and liking horror. Like, that's, you know, that was like for me, like that was the horror of being queer, is like worrying that like something was going to manifest on my body if I slept with the wrong person. And like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, sex was
exactly.
scary. And like, it's like, oh, I have a rash. What does that mean?
die? Yeah. Terry, when did you first see The Brood? What was your experience with seeing The Brood?
I am unfortunately not as familiar with Cronenberg's work. I've seen his more mainstream stuff, like The Fly and The Dead Zone and History of Violence. I've seen those. I saw The Brood for the first time about two and a half years ago.
Oh, wow.
And it's quickly become, I've only seen, this is like what, the fourth film of his that I've seen, but it's easily my favorite of his films. But yeah, I'm unfortunately not as well versed in Cronenberg's
so, like,
work as I'd like
Videodrome?
To. Never seen Videodrome, never seen Shivers or Rabbit or
Rabbit.
None of them. Mm-mm.
Oh, you should Dead Ringers. You should see Dead
Not
Ringers.
Dead Ringers.
Oh,
you should, no.
Oh, man.
So if you like The Brood, you should watch Dead Ringers.
Yeah.
That shit's weird, but it's so good. That's one of my that's also another one of my favorite Cronenbergs, and that one's just absolutely weird, but incredible.
In the same way, in the same good way.
It's like sexy and like kind of body horror, but like not as goopy, but like very sexy,
very sexual,
and you feel very like.
Dirty.
Should I be turned on by this?
Yeah.
And yes and no at the same
time.
It's a great experience.
The two Davids, David Lynch and David Cronenberg, I'm unfortunately not well versed in, and I want to, there's a plan in place. I'm going to watch a lot of their films and get to know them, because they are definitely one of my blind spots in horror, unfortunately. But no, what I really liked about this film in particular, and I think it's probably true of most of his, especially his like more body horror kind of horror aspect of it, is he does this really good job of what I think good horror does, and taking sort of internal fears and internal like horrors and then making them external. So like I mean, in some ways, this movie is a divorce drama, and I was doing some research on it, and I know that he wrote this coming out of a very acrimonious divorce with his wife and a custody battle with for his daughter. And he saw, like, he had read, I think the script hadn't come out yet, but he'd read the script for Kramer versus Kramer, and he's like, I want to make Kramer versus Kramer but more realistic. And so he does this. But like, there's a lot of this idea of the things that people either, I think especially in like a bad relationship or like a relationship that's deteriorating, might think about each other or might, you know, say in like private. And he kind of takes those internal things and makes it external here. And it's done in such a horrific way that it's just, it's so, so effective.
Yeah. Well, the best horror always seems to do that. Like that, you know, you take personal fears and personal trauma and then find a way to externalize it and, you know, let the genre kind of be the window dressing, you know, mm-hmm. on top of the, you know, those weird personal hangups, you know, that's when it works best.
Yeah. And I was thinking as I was watching this about, and I mean, we mentioned him earlier, but Zulawski's Possession, cause that mm-hmm. was also a movie that came out of a very acrimonious divorce. And like, it has kind of similar aspects where it's like taking a look at relationships through the use of horror and the idea of possession and stuff. And so cause that was the movie that I saw, but I actually saw that before this one. And so that's sort of like, I was saying that going, ooh, this is like Possession, except a little bit more body horror aspect of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I like, and The Brood especially, like, because they do focus more on the little girl's experience with divorce. Not as much, but there is a little bit more kind of looking at how she's torn between her parents. And like, as someone whose parents are divorced, I really enjoyed seeing that because like, I was that age when my parents got divorced. And no, my mom did not develop an external womb sac, unfortunately. Everybody, I apologize to spoil that to you, that my mom did not do that. I
so
wish
this
she
isn't
had.
A biopic?
No, it is not a biopic about my own. I know. I say that, and like, I'm going to see it this weekend. I'm
although,
like, oh,
I think
shit.
Samantha Eggers would be a, like, Nola would be a pretty rad mom to have.
Honestly, she doesn't seem. We'll get to that. We'll get to her because, but that's what I liked about this movie is looking at like how the kid gets really stuck in the middle of like in the divorce and how they become a tool of. A tool for parents to use against each other and how they be, yeah, it's just, especially with, you know, she has bruises on her body and like, oh, well, Nola can't have access to her anymore because there's bruises and, you know, that kind of using it as a bargaining chip and the position a kid gets placed into and then what that inflicts upon the child. Cause I think a big part of this is they don't think about really what is like Candy's going through. They're like, oh yeah, she's a kid, but I don't think they ever take a moment to think about how she's experiencing this. And like, mm-hmm. and at the end, obviously you see that the little growth mm-hmm. of her own trauma manifesting mm-hmm. and how kids' emotional well-being isn't necessarily considered a lot during
first
divorces.
And foremost, yeah. And, like, and I like also never. Like hear how like you're never really given the truth. Like you're given sort of Nola's version of what her mother did to her and like her grand, like, but you never really know what exactly happened. And that to me was also super interesting as watching it as an adult.
Yeah, exactly. Especially like when you're a kid and you also don't always know what's going on. Like, especially and even now as like an adult with divorced parents, I still don't know what actually happened. Like a lot of the time it's like they both have such different stories because their divorce was not super good. But like, it's so fascinating thinking about that. Like what is, you're never going to know the truth as a kid about that divorce. And it's so weird and kind of fucks you up if you think about it too much.
Well, I was thinking this time in particular, the conversation that Juliana, the grandmother, Nola's mother has with Frank, where she talks about, you know, being a parent and being blamed for everything. Like this quote is being blamed for everything, to have the past distorted so you don't even recognize yourself in it. And then later on, she says 30 seconds after you're born, you have a past. And 60 seconds after that, you start to lie to yourself about it. And it's such that in particular, that 30 seconds, 60 seconds thing seems so duplicitous in some way of like, she's talking about her daughter and she's saying that her daughter is distorted this view of her, but at the same time, you could also look at it as being like the way that Juliana might have lied to herself about her relationship to her daughter. And it creates this sort of like, you're not 100% sure, like you both said, about what really happened in Nola's household, but something absolutely did.
Yeah. And they all probably lied about it, like in their own way. Like not one of them probably you know, has the truth as the basis. Like, they all have their own versions of the truth.
Right. Cause then again, you know, she, of course, one of the whole like things of this is Nola lashing out in revenge at the people she thinks have wronged her. And so she goes after her mother, of course. And then also there's the conversation that she has with Raglan about her father, and, you know, that he kind of ignored the violence and was a bystander for it. And so she lashes out at him. And so there's a lot of like, this idea of, well, I mean, generational trauma that we talked about, where it's like the things that are inflicted on us, we're now like lashing out back at, and it sort of envelops her. And then it also trickles down to her daughter, and it creates this like cycle of abuse in a way.
It's so fuck. Okay. I'm getting personal because this movie hits me very personally every time I watch it for different reasons, but like, I am not a mother and I do not want to be a mother, but the more I watch this, the more I feel like Nola, because I had a very weird parental situation growing up, and I don't want to have kids because I'm terrified of passing that trauma on to them because of my relationship with my dad and my mom and stuff. And so this movie hits harder every time I watch it as I go to therapy and learn more about my relationship with my family. And it's like, holy shit. Like, it is wild the way that you kind of try to process that as an adult and what that comes out as you get older, and like what trauma looks like as you age and how it is so different, and how you process it, how you talk about it,
how you hang on to it,
how you hang on to it. Yeah. And how it really affects you like in so many different ways. And yeah, so I identify again, I don't have an external womb sac yet, but what I'm saying is I'm probably going to develop one.
Like, if we see you in one of those moo-moo things perched on a cushion, like, perhaps.
Yeah. That actually might be my Halloween costume this year.
Yes.
I would love to go as Candy one year.
Yes.
Like, in a little snowsuit and a blonde wig. And, like, nobody would know. Like, you know, 4% of the people that I would run into would know who I was, but I would love it.
That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, this movie hits me so hard every single time, because then I just think about my own trauma, which is, I mean, great, good for him. Like, he really tapped into that shit really well.
Well, because it's also like, it's not like a, like, it's actually like a, you know, it's a relationship drama.
Yes,
like, you know, I mean,
exactly.
There's horrific scenes in it, but it's also like, it's a straight up, like, well done drama. And like, that was kind of, I'm sure, lost on me when I saw it as a kid, but like, you know, it's always so exciting when something works on that level as well as being scary, like, you know, it's so good at doing that.
When I think about, I mean, this movie, you know, there, I think there are two different things that it's pursuing. Yes, I think that this is a way of that Cronenberg was able to sort of process the horrible divorce that he was going through in the custody battle, because you can obviously see that in here. But there's a lot of stuff in here with all the characters dealing with their parents. Like, the opening scene introduces us to Mike, who is being treated, I'm not really sure, by Raglan through his trauma of not being quote unquote manly enough by his father. And so there's that whole conversation about gender and about like this idea of weak and strong that Mike apparently isn't to his father. And that kind of hit me as like a queer person growing up, is like, you know, being sort of like I wasn't into sports. I wasn't the sort of manly man, you know, and that idea of that aspect of it just sort of sets the tone for this story that is really a drama about family, about families and the hurt that we can inflict on our progeny. Mm-hmm.
And what's fucking scarier than that, man? That's the reason I want to have kids. I'm not ready to like shape a child and put a child through trauma. That is the most terrifying thing to me.
It's kind of inevitable, I think.
Right? And like, everyone has trauma. Like, you can't avoid it. But I can't have that responsibility. Yeah. I refuse to claim that responsibility.
When I think about how this is absolutely a tragedy, particularly from Nola's perspective, because at the very end of the movie, she kind of becomes what she hated. And so there's like, because early on in the movie, she's, you know, she's having that conversation with Raglan, and he's asking about, you know, if she hurt Candace, and she's like, mommies don't do that. They don't hurt their children. And then it's like, well, they sometimes do, but those are bad mommies. Those are fucked up mommies, like mine was, fucked up and bad. And then by the end of the movie, she's telling her ex-husband, I guess, I'd kill Candace before I let you take her away from me.
Yeah.
And so by the end of the movie, she is gone from this, like, mommies don't hurt their kids, to I'm going to have this kid and I will kill her if you try to take her away. And that's horrific. And that's sad.
Yeah. And poor Candy, like, she's the one, like, you know, that the she's like the most like morose little, like, that poor,
I know,
that face, like, that, you know. And I mean, just there's, I mean, she doesn't smile once in that whole movie, except like,
no,
there's one brief moment with her teacher, that, you know, when he came in, you know, to pick her up, like, that was the only moment that there was like a, you know, a glimmer of like lightness to that poor little girl's life.
I know, the rest of it, she's just becoming more and more catatonic. And then by the end of the film, she is literally mute in the car, just like crying silently as like,
yeah,
the horror inside of her is now coming on the outside. So it's like that, again, that cyclical trauma is now infesting in her. And it's horrifying.
I was really happy to read an interview with her where she said that like everybody was like were super friendly and they had so much fun, mm-hmm, and they laughed. And like, it was like a really kind of good experience filming that she had, like with the little guys that played the brood and with Art Hindle who played her dad, and like, you know, that it wasn't as traumatic as, you know, it would seem like it should have been.
I feel like whenever I hear that, it's like the more traumatic the child character, the more fun they had on set. And I'm like, you know, at least they had that. Like, at least, yeah, the kid themselves isn't hopefully traumatized from being in that role.
Yeah.
But another thing I think relating to Nola's motherhood is this idea of monstrous motherhood and how this film deals with monstrous motherhood, mm-hmm, in two different ways. You obviously have like her becoming a bad mother to Candy, but then she becomes her own a mother and father. She is like the epitome of a man's worst nightmare because she can reproduce without a penis and she can like make her own children and make her own progeny without them. And I think that's badass. Like, I think that's cool as shit. And I know that it's supposed to be monstrous and scary, but I think it's cool. They're murderous. Yeah. But the fact that, like she can now have her own children and it's meant to be terrifying. But to me, it's like, yeah, exactly. And she's kind of monstrous. She's like an animal. She's licking like the birthing fluids off of, she's tearing open the sack of her teeth.
Yeah.
Like, it's so gross because you're like, that's what an animal does. Like, an animal rips open the amniotic sac, that, and they lick the everything off and they clean the baby when, like, you know, humans don't do that. We wipe the baby clean with like a towel. But she's doing this all on her own and she's so proud of herself.
Yes.
And it's such a cool, to me, it's like a triumphant moment in a way where it's supposed to be it's obviously this horrifying reveal of, holy shit, she's having her own babies her own way and they're monsters. But it's also like, look what I can do without you. Like, look what I have accomplished.
Mother figure who's going to do it all on her own.
Yes, like, look what I accomplished without you. And of course she's killed because she's a monster and people don't like monstrous mothers. But I think there is just, it's a fascinating, she is one of my favorite mothers in horror. Like, even though she's a bad mother, yeah, I think she's so much more complex than a bad mother. And I think Cronenberg does a decent job of giving her more, a little bit more depth than just like a bad mom who's crazy.
Yeah.
And I love her so much.
I love hearing that because when I was looking at the IMDb page for this movie, and they have the trivia, which of course anyone can go in there and add trivia, you know, it's sort of like Wikipedia, you can edit it. So, you know, you take some of it as a grain of salt, but there was one point of trivia in there that I was like, did we watch the same movie? And it's this comment and it's, quote, one of the rare movies where Oliver Reed isn't the villain. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure he is the villain of this. And I'm pretty sure because, like, you brought up earlier, Mary Beth, the Frankenstein. He is sort of Frankenstein and he has created, for better or for worse, this monstrous mother out of himself. He created her into being
his intention. Like, I don't know if his intention is to, you know, I mean, I think that he wants to be respected and he wants to be powerful and he wants to have recognition and sort of be famous for this psychoplasmics. But like, I always thought that like, he didn't from the outset know that this was going to happen. Like that,
yeah,
this sort of is something that went off in this direction and that he sort of realized that, you know, the potential that it had and kind of went along with it. So maybe he was like an unwitting villain, but like, yeah, it's kind of gray. A gray area for sure.
Yeah, because I feel like he's taking advantage of all of his patients, obviously.
Yeah, he's manipulative for sure.
Exploiting their trauma for his own research paper, which I feel like a lot of scientists do.
His own book, his own paper, his own Soma Institute. Like, yeah, 100%.
And like, I think I think this is a movie where I don't think there it can be like an outright villain. You know what I mean? Like the more we talk about it, the more it's like there are bad people in it, but everyone in this movie kind of sucks. You know what I mean? Like everyone has done something fucked up.
Except for poor Candy.
Well, I know, poor Candy.
Candy. Well, poor Candy. Poor Candy. Like all the adults. All the adults have done something, have done terrible things. And so they're all kind of reaping the consequences of their actions, taken to an extreme, obviously. But like he does like lock her in that house. The Raglan is like, yeah, hey, let's lock you away in here in the shed and lock and like have bunk beds of your weird monstrous brood. Yeah. And
I mean, it's a nice shed, but
yeah, I guess. But also, you let your kid, like, you want a kid to go visit there. Like, what do they do? Whatever. But it's like I don't think he knew it was going to happen, but he definitely took advantage of it for sure. I think everyone in the situation, like, I think it got out of control for everyone so quickly, and like everyone's transgressions just kind of got taken to the like nth degree without them realizing the like what would actually come of that.
How far it would actually go.
I mean, I know some critics in the past have accused I think this movie in particular, but Cronenberg of sort of misogyny sometimes. And I don't necessarily see that in here. And I actually saw there's an article by a woman named Carrie Rickey that wrote on Criterion.com. She was writing about the Criterion release for this film, where she was talking about how that this movie, it's sort of blaming the victim. After all, we're talking about a movie where male scientists use women as guinea pigs and then are shocked when the test results become monstrous. Let me invoke the Jessica Rabbit defense. The women are not bad. They're just drawn that way. It's the male scientists who have inadvertently transformed them into men's worst nightmares. And so I was thinking about that in particular too, you know, this seeing that and then also seeing the trivia point about Oliver Reed not being the villain. And yeah, it's definitely a gray area. But like, I think that she brings up a good point that like this is something that was created by man. And so she in a lot of ways, Nola and by proxy, Candy are the victims of.
Yeah, they're
the
like the conduit of whatever fucked up thing that he's doing. Like, Nola doesn't, I mean, as horrific and as monstrous as she is, like, to me, she never seemed like she was the bad guy. Like, or the bad, you know, the villain. I mean, bad guy, not bad guy.
Like, we didn't really learn much about her as a parent before that. I feel like she's kind of, we don't know much about their relationship. Like, you know, obviously there's trouble. And her relationship with her family caused problems. But it's like there's no like she was an abusive mother. Like there was never anything that kind of marked her as a bad person, maybe, or more just like a person with a lot of issues and baggage to unpack.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same way that sort of her. We don't really know much about her past. Right. Where, you know, we see her perspective that her mom was abusive and her father allowed the abuse to happen. But then we also don't see her as an adult. So we don't really know. We don't know anything about the relationship just other than what we see on the screen at that point.
Yep. In that one room where she is, where she's like the whole, like, you know, she's like basically sits down the whole movie until that one moment when she like lifts up her dress and sort of gets up on her knees.
Well, we've only ever seen her as his experiment, not as like a living person before all the shit started happening. So we don't know anything really about her or her parenting style, like you said, or any of that kind of aspect. It's just his experiment.
Made flesh.
I love this fucking movie so much. Oh, it's just so good. And
if you ever get a chance to see it in that projected in a theater.
Oh,
I saw it a couple years ago. They played it at the like the Museum of the Moving Image, I think, like a 35mm restored print in a beautiful, like, it was amazing. It was so good.
There's nothing like seeing a 35 print of a movie that was filmed in that. I just I love that.
The fact, like, I mean, I was in love with the photography, and the guy that shot it, like, he shot, weird fact. Do you guys know Tanya's Island by chance? The movie?
I don't think so.
Anyway, he shot Tanya's Island, which is a total, like, left field reference, but it's like a, you know, do you know who the singer Vanity is? Like, one of Prince's side singer girls. It's basically a Sasquatch Blue Lagoon mix with like a tropical island Sasquatch.
Oh,
and anyway, that he also shot that I watched recently, and I was like, they shot that. You know, he shot both of these.
I love the IMDb summary: a female model faces off against an ape on a tropical island.
Yeah, it basically she falls in love with him, and it's like a Rick Baker Sasquatch. It's like it's young Rick Baker. It's really really well done.
Huh?
Yeah.
Is that? I wonder if that's streaming anywhere. I'd like to see that. Oh, it is available on IMDb.
Sorry to change the subject.
No. Well, I do want to talk a little bit about kind of another aspect that I think this film covers is sort of the idea of like this addiction to revenge and this addiction to that kind of mentality, because you have Nola seeking revenge against everyone that she either truthfully or maybe not believes has hurt her. But then you also see like Mike acting out sort of like a revenge aspect with his father of like, you know, trying to come into his own and using that addiction to Raglan. But then you also have that, you mentioned the guy that has the kind of growths on his throat. Yeah. He's also seeking revenge from Raglan. And he's like, he wants to take this to court, not because he's going to win, but because it'll be bad publicity. And he's like, just remember the slogan, psychoplasmics can cause cancer. He just wants to fuck him back over.
There, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Fred Candy's dad wants, you know, in his own way, he wants revenge. He wants her to be safe, but he also wants to, you know, to sort of get back and hurt his crazy wife, who may not be crazy.
Right. And that was that was a line from the movie that just really like stuck with me this time, where he's like, and I don't remember where I wrote it down at, but
craziness rubbing off on him.
Yes. Yeah. Where he's like that, you know, she's crazy, he's sane. And that's why he was sort of the rock. And I'm just like, but were you?
Yeah.
Well, that's I have a lot of feelings too about the dad and this and how he's like, I am the sane one. I am the good boy. You are the crazy mother.
Yeah.
And that is a fascinating dynamic as well, where he's like, it's almost like he also wants revenge against her for ruining their child and like ruining his life, because obviously he's like kind of schmoozing a little bit with the teacher. And it's just interesting how everyone here has their own motivations and are very kind of mad at everybody and wants someone to blame for their problems except for themselves. Not in Nola's case necessarily, but like in the husband's case.
Yeah. Cause life is complicated. It's easier to blame someone else for your shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's about as messy as an external womb sac.
Yeah.
Speaking of womb sacs. Do we want to give us our rating out of 5, y'all?
Yes.
All right, Terry, how many external womb sacs out of 5 do you give this beautiful, beautiful film?
Oh, boy. You know, when I was looking at my letterbox, I had given it a 4, and I think that's too low. Because I mentioned this earlier, but what I do think The Brood does, that what good horror does, is take internal fears and internal thoughts and makes them external and shows us sort of like that kind of goopy, gory inside that we don't want to think about, or we don't want to talk about, or the thoughts that we might have when we're angry at someone. And this movie externalizes them in such a fascinating way, in such a kind of gory body horror way, but like it works so well for me. I do think that, again, I've only seen maybe 4 of his films, but I do think this might be my favorite of his films, because up until this point, The Fly has always been my favorite. I love The Fly, and it's a little bit more commercial, obviously, but this film, gosh, there's just, I mean, we just talked about so much of the sort of themes that it kind of touches on, and there's so much going on in this little adaptation of like a divorce, and it just, I don't know. It really worked for me this on this viewing. And I just fell much more in love with everything that Cronenberg was doing. So I think 5, I'm going to give it 5. What is it? External.
External sex. Sex.
But I'm just going to sit over here and just spend my time licking while the rest of you talk.
Lick them clean. Lick them clean.
What about you, Mary Beth?
I will also be giving this 5 external womb sex out of 5. Like nice. I said, this is my favorite Cronenberg. I think this is body horror done in the most perfect way, in that it's goopy, it's gross, and also really hits home a very personal message about trauma. And I think it's such a great balance of that I think deserves way more appreciation for what it's able to do. I know there's a lot of trauma and horror, but I think this one is just a really great balance of telling a family drama and a horror story at the same time. And like I said before, it continues to hit home every time I watch it in very different ways. Let that say what it does about me, whatever. But I appreciate this movie every time, even more every time I see it. And yeah. Carter, you have the final word. How many external womb sacs out of 5 do you give?
Do you even have to ask? Five juicy, bloody external wound sacks for sure. Yeah. I mean, this is like you guys, this is my favorite Cronenberg film. And I mean, just the fact that I saw it too young and it was my introduction to Cronenberg, and it was my introduction to body horror, and it was my introduction to horror that was smart, for lack of a better word. And it was, you know, the first time that I saw a horror movie that was doing something besides just trying to scare me, which is kind of what I love the most about horror, you know, is that you can, you know, kind of find ways to do that stuff, you know, while still being scary. So I will say five external bloody womb sacks forever.
You know, I was just thinking that when you were talking about this, it just reminded me again that you were 13 when you saw this movie. And what a, I mean, I can't imagine being 13 and seeing this movie, because it's so sexual and it's so like.
Well, it's really adult too.
Yeah.
Like it's like really adult.
It's really adult. And I mean, like, I probably identify with Candy. Like, my parents are together. Like, they were, you know, it was kind of like, it wasn't that, but it was, I was definitely had more in common with Candy than I did, you know, with anyone else in the film. But yeah, way too young. Thank you to that ballet mom and that unmarked VHS tape.
I just, you know, when someone is handing you an unmarked VHS tape, that you're going to see some shit.
Yeah.
You just know.
It could have been a lot worse.
it could have been. Yeah. Have you ever had those VHS tapes where it's like you've recorded over things so much that sometimes things like bleed through?
Yes.
And it's like... Okay, this is my favorite story, because we had some of these in our basement and my parents had to hide them from us because their friend gave them like VHS recordings of movies, but he would put porn on them as a joke. And we didn't know that. Like, obviously we were kids. Like, we didn't fucking know that was a thing. So they had to hide them because they were like, oh fuck, these are the porn VHS. Like, these are the porn VHSs that our friend gave us. And we don't even like, yeah. A different time. Yeah. A different time.
Accidentally stumbling upon your parents' porn collection. That's happened.
But like, not even their porn. Like,
I know.
Like
that's
porn
what they
that,
said. Maybe.
That's true. That's a very good point. That's a very, very good point.
Yeah, who's going to own up to having a porn collection to their kid?
Like, on VHS tapes, unmarked, like, in the living room.
Love that.
I'm going home this weekend, so
gonna have a conversation.
Mom, do you still have that? No.
Well, thank you so much, Carter, for joining us to talk about The Brood and allowing us to just kind of dive into it. Where can our listeners find you, and what do you have that you'd like to share or plug?
They can find me on Instagram at my All the Dead Boys account, which is all_the_dead_boys, or allthedeadboys.com.
And we'll throw all that in the,
yeah,
in the show notes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's all. I mean, you know, Swallowed will be, you know, coming together slowly but surely over the next couple of months. So
can't wait.
Yeah. So excited. So listeners, you've heard from us, but we want to hear from you. What was your experience with The Brood? You can send us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us directly on Twitter. I am at MB McAndrews.
And I'm at Gailey Dreadful.
And of course, don't forget to follow the podcast on Twitter at Scarred Podcast.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe.
Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you everyone for listening. Please stay safe out there. But most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.
As a person with a very deep voice, I'm hired all the time for advertising campaigns. But a deep voice doesn't sell B2B, and advertising on the wrong platform doesn't sell B2B either. That's why if you're a B2B marketer, you should use LinkedIn ads. LinkedIn has the targeting capabilities to help you reach the world's largest professional audience. That's right, over 70 million decision makers all in one place. All the big wigs, then medium wigs.
Also small wigs who are on the path to becoming big wigs. Okay, that's enough about wigs. LinkedIn ads allows you to focus on getting your B2B message to the right people. So, does that mean you should use ads on LinkedIn instead of hiring me, the man with the deepest voice in the world? Yes. Yes, it does. Get started today and see why LinkedIn is the place to be, to be. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
What is The Briefing Room? It's a behind-the-scenes look at how the criminal justice system works and the lives of the people within that system. If you love true crime, well, these are the real people who do the job every day of making sure justice is served. Hi, I'm Detective Dave. I'm Detective Dan. Together, we have decades of experience in local law enforcement, a profession that we think is often misunderstood. So we're going to explore how to do it right, and we won't shy away from when it's done wrong. These are stories you'll hear nowhere else. Unique, frank, and unvarnished. From the team that brought you Small Town Dicks, this is The Briefing Room. Episode 1 drops on August 30th. We'll meet you in The Briefing Room.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.